beliefs say that God knows and cares about the honesty of the parties. The anthropologist Pascal Boyer points out that gods and ancestor spirits are often thought to be omniscient, yet what they most care about in this vast universe is the moral intentions hidden in the hearts of the living. Respect for rules is enhanced when rules have an element of sacredness, and when they are backed up by supernatural sanction and the gossip or ostracism of one's peers. Wilson's claim is that religious ideas and brains that responded to those ideas co-evolved. Even if the belief in supernatural entities emerged originally for some other reason, or as an accidental byproduct in the evolution of cognition, as some scholars have claimed, groups that parlayed those beliefs into social coordination devices, for example by linking them to emotions such as shame, fear, guilt, and love, found a cultural solution to the free rider problem, and then reaped the enormous benefits of trust and cooperation. If stronger belief led to greater individual benefits, or if a group developed a way to punish or exclude those who did not share in its beliefs and practices, conditions were perfect for the co-evolution of religion and religious brains. Consistent with Wilson's proposal, the geneticist Dean Hammer recently reported evidence from twin studies that suggests a particular gene may be associated with a stronger tendency to have religious and self-transcendent experiences. Religion, therefore, could have pulled human beings into the group selection loophole. By making people long ago feel and act as though they were part of one body, religion reduced the influence of individual selection, which shapes individuals to be selfish, and brought into play the force of group selection, which shapes individuals to work for the good of their group. But we didn't make it all the way through the loophole. Human nature is a complex mix of preparations for extreme selfishness and extreme altruism. Which side of our nature we express depends on culture and context. When opponents of evolution object that human beings are not mere apes, they are correct. We are also part B. Harmony and purpose. Reading Wilson's Darwin's Cathedral is like taking a journey to spaceland. You can look down on the vast tapestry of human cultures and see why things are woven in the way that they are. Wilson says his own private hell would be to be locked forever into a room full of people discussing the hypocrisies of religion, for example, that many religions preach love, compassion, and virtue, yet sometimes cause war, hatred, and terrorism. From Wilson's higher perspective, there is no contradiction. Group selection creates interlocking genetic and cultural adaptations that enhance peace, harmony, and cooperation within the group for the express purpose of increasing the group's ability to compete with other groups. Group selection does not end conflict. It just pushes it up to the next level of social organization. Atrocities committed in the name of religion are almost always committed against out-group members, or against the most dangerous people of all, apostates, who try to leave the group, and traitors, who undermine the group. A second puzzle that Wilson can solve is why mysticism, everywhere and always, is about transcending the self and merging with something larger than the self. When William James analyzed mysticism, he focused on the psychological state of cosmic consciousness and on the techniques developed in all the major religions to attain it. Hindus and Buddhists use meditation and yoga to attain the state of samadhi, in which the subject-object distinction and one's sense of an individual self disappear in a state usually described as one of supreme peace, bliss, and illumination. James found much the same goal in Christian and Muslim mysticism, often attained through repetitive prayer. He quoted the 11th century Muslim philosopher Al-Ghazali, who spent several years worshiping with the Sufis of Syria. Al-Ghazali attained experiences of transport and revelation that he said cannot be described in words, although he did try to explain to his Muslim readers the essence of Sufism. The first condition for a Sufi is to purge his heart entirely of all that is not God. The next key of the contemplative life consists in the humble prayers which escape from the fervent soul, and in the meditations on God in which the heart is swallowed up entirely. But in reality, this is only the beginning of the Sufi life, the end of Sufism being total absorption in God. From Wilson's perspective, mystical experience is an off button for the self. When the self is turned off, people become just a cell in the larger body, a bee in the larger hive. It is no wonder that the after effects of mystical experience are predictable. People usually feel a stronger commitment to God or to helping others, often by bringing them to God. The neuroscientist Andrew Newberg has studied the brains of people undergoing mystical experiences, mostly during meditation, and has found where that off switch might be. In the rear portion of the brain's parietal lobes, under the rear portion of the top of the skull, are two patches of cortex Newberg calls the orientation association areas. The patch in the left hemisphere appears to contribute to the mental sensation of having a limited and physically defined body, and thus keeps track of your edges. The corresponding area in the right hemisphere maintains a map of the space around you. These two areas receive input from your senses to help them maintain an ongoing representation of yourself and its location in space. At the very moment when people report achieving states of mystical union, these two areas appear to be cut off. Input from other parts of the brain is reduced, and overall activity in these orientation areas is reduced too. But Newberg believes they are still trying to do their jobs. The area on the left tries to establish the body's boundaries and doesn't find them. The area on the right tries to establish the self's location in space and doesn't find it. The person experiences a loss of self combined with a paradoxical expansion of the self out into space, yet with no fixed location in the normal world of three dimensions. The person feels merged with something vast, something larger than the self. Newberg believes that rituals that involve repetitive movement and chanting, particularly when they are performed by many people at the same time, help to set up resonance patterns in the brains of the participants that make this mystical state more likely to happen. The historian William McNeill, drawing on very different data, came to the same conclusion. When McNeill was drafted into the U.S. Army in 1941, basic training required that he march for hundreds of hours on the drill field in close formation with a few dozen other men. At first, McNeill thought the marching was just a way to pass the time because his base had no weapons with which to train. But after a few weeks of training, the marching began to induce in him an altered state of consciousness. Words are inadequate to describe the emotion aroused by the prolonged movement in unison that drilling involved. A sense of pervasive well-being is what I recall. More specifically, a strange sense of personal enlargement, a sort of swelling out, becoming bigger than life, thanks to participation in collective ritual. Decades later, McNeill studied the role that synchronized movement in dance, religious ritual, and military training has played in history. In Keeping Together in Time, he concludes that human societies since the beginning of recorded history have used synchronized movement to create harmony and cohesion within groups, sometimes in the service of preparing for hostilities with other groups. McNeill's conclusion suggests that synchronized movement and chanting might be evolved mechanisms for activating the altruistic motivations created in the process of group selection. The extreme self-sacrifice characteristic of group-selected species, such as ants and bees, can often be found among soldiers. McNeill quotes an extraordinary passage from the book The Warriors, Reflections of Men in Battle, that describes the thrilling communal state that soldiers sometimes enter. I passes insensibly into a we, my becomes our, and individual fate loses its central importance. I believe that it is nothing less than the assurance of immortality that makes self-sacrifice at these moments so relatively easy. I may fall, but I do not die. For that which is real in me goes forward and lives on in the comrades for whom I gave up my life. There is indeed something larger than the self, able to provide people with a sense of purpose they think worth dying for. The group. Of course, one group's noble purpose is sometimes another group's pure evil. The meaning of life. What can you do to have a good, happy, fulfilling, and meaningful life? What is the answer to the question of purpose within life? I believe the answer can be found only by understanding the kind of creature that we are, divided in the many ways we are divided. We were shaped by individual selection to be selfish creatures who struggle for resources, pleasure, and prestige, and we were shaped by group selection to be hive creatures who long to lose ourselves in something larger. We are social creatures who need love and attachments, and we are industrious creatures with needs for effectance, able to enter a state of vital engagement with our work. We are the writer and we are the elephant, and our mental health depends on the two working together, each drawing on the other's strengths. I don't believe there is an inspiring answer to the question, what is the purpose of life? Yet by drawing on ancient wisdom and modern science, we can find compelling answers to the question of purpose within life. The final version of the happiness hypothesis is that happiness comes from between. Happiness is not something that you can find, acquire, or achieve directly. You have to get the conditions right and then wait. Some of those conditions are within you, such as coherence among the parts and levels of your personality. Other conditions require relationships to things beyond you. Just as plants need sun, water, and good soil to thrive, people need love, work, and a connection to something larger. It is worth striving to get the right relationships between yourself and others, between yourself and your work, and between yourself and something larger than yourself. If you get these relationships right, a sense of purpose and meaning will emerge. Chapter 11. Conclusion on Balance. All things come into being by conflict of opposites. Heraclitus, circa 500 BCE. Without contraries is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. William Blake, circa 1790. The ancient Chinese symbol of yin and yang represents the value of the eternally shifting balance between seemingly opposed principles. As the epigrams above from Heraclitus and Blake show, this is not just an Eastern idea. It is great idea. A timeless insight that in a way summarizes the rest of this book. Religion and science, for example, are often thought to be opponents, but as I have shown, the insights of ancient religions and of modern science are both needed to reach a full understanding of human nature and the conditions of human satisfaction. The ancients may have known little about biology, chemistry, and physics, but many were good psychologists. Psychology and religion can benefit by taking each other seriously, or at least by agreeing to learn from each other while overlooking the areas of irreconcilable difference. The Eastern and Western approaches to life are also said to be opposed. The East stresses acceptance and collectivism. The West encourages striving and individualism. But as we've seen, both perspectives are valuable. Happiness requires changing yourself and changing your world. It requires pursuing your own goals and fitting in with others. Different people at different times in their lives will benefit from drawing more heavily on one approach or the other. And finally, liberals and conservatives are opponents in the most literal sense, each using the myth of pure evil to demonize the other side and unite their own. But the most important lesson I have learned in my 20 years of research on morality is that nearly all people are morally motivated. Selfishness is a powerful force, particularly in the decisions of individuals. But whenever groups of people come together to make a sustained effort to change the world, you can bet that they are pursuing a vision of virtue, justice, or sacredness. Material self-interest does little to explain the passions of partisans on issues such as abortion, the environment, or the role of religion in public life. Self-interest certainly cannot explain terrorism, but the selflessness made possible by group selection can. An important dictum of cultural psychology is that each culture develops expertise in some aspects of human existence, but no culture can be expert in all aspects. The same goes for the two ends of the political spectrum. My research confirms the common perception that liberals are experts in thinking about issues of victimization, equality, autonomy, and the rights of individuals, particularly those of minorities and nonconformists. Conservatives, on the other hand, are experts in thinking about loyalty to the group, respect for authority and tradition, and sacredness. When one side overwhelms the other, the results are likely to be ugly. A society without liberals would be harsh and oppressive to many individuals. A society without conservatives would lose many of the social structures and constraints that Durkheim showed are so valuable. Anomy would increase along with freedom. A good place to look for wisdom, therefore, is where you least expect to find it, in the minds of your opponents. You already know the ideas common on your own side. If you can take off the blinders of the myth of pure evil, you might see some good ideas for the first time. By drawing on wisdom that is balanced, ancient and new, Eastern and Western, even liberal and conservative, we can choose directions in life that will lead to satisfaction, happiness, and a sense of meaning. We can't simply select a destination and then walk there directly. The writer does not have that much authority, but by drawing on humanity's greatest ideas and best science, we can train the elephant, know our possibilities as well as our limits, and live wisely. This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, written by Jonathan Haidt, read by Ryan Vincent Anderson. Produced and recorded by Audio Media Production. Post-production by Audio Media Production. The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, is also available in print and digital formats from Basic Books, an imprint of Perseus Books Group, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2006 by Jonathan Haidt. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.